Well, thank you very much, Mark. It's nice to come and talk here with so many familiar faces. I'm going to have to try to stand over here a little bit because I'm going to use my pointer to hit the screen. So I appreciate it's always fun to come and talk to you guys. I wanted to start tonight with a little story. Now, I saw Ed Wenzel earlier tonight, and I made him promise not to ask me any questions about the Battle of Chantilly. But that doesn't mean I can't talk about Ed. So what I don't think I've ever told this story, but when I was working on this book, Brian Pohanka was still alive. And so I would be talking to him and asking him questions. And I, this is, you know, my very first book. And I have to, the thing I remember him always saying was, Chuck, keep working on the book. Chuck, keep working on the book. So Ed knows how this goes, but when you get to the end of writing a book, you want to get somebody really well-known to write one of those fabulous little blurbs on the back cover for you. Okay, you know, somebody's with a big name, they come out and say, buy this book, it's wonderful. So I had called Brian, and I said, you know, the book's pretty well done. Would you be kind enough to take a look at it and see if you could say something nice for the back cover? And at that point, you know, he had cancer in his eyes, so his eyesight wasn't that strong. And he said, Chuck, I'd love to do it, but, you know, I really can't. But he said, has Ed Wenzel read the book? And I said, Ed has read every word. And he said, all right, if Ed has read the book and he's fine with it, I'll be glad to write something for you. So, Ed, I don't even know if I've even told you that story. It's been a long time since we did it. But, again, I always have to say thank you to Ed when I get up to talk about this book. So, what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you the maps of the routes that the soldiers took, you know, to and from the battle. I don't know about you guys, but when I first got interested in the Civil War, the first thing I did was look, well, what battle was fought right around me? And of course, I live up in Herndon, so this is just a few miles south of me, you know, down at Ox Hill. And I have to be honest that one of the things that I said to myself was, man, I wonder if anybody walked across my property, you know, way back then, 150 years ago. And I'm sure some of you have probably thought the same thing about your property. Mm-hmm. And that was, in the beginning, I didn't know anything about, you know, writing books. But I started to read, you know, what I could find, and I started to draw maps. Okay, soldiers coming from 2nd Manassas, how, you know, the North and the South got the battlefield and, you know, where they went after that. And that's really how I kind of got started. Then I was actually in a photography club, still in a photography club, and I gave myself an assignment to go out and photograph these locations, help me understand things a little bit more. And, you know, long story short, it eventually got published by the Fairfax County History Commission. So that's what I'm going to talk to you tonight. And it's kind of interesting because I'm going to show you some pictures. It's funny. I have my notes. I was just telling Ed, you know, this book was published in 2002, and it's probably been a good 8-10 years since I've given this presentation. But I have notes in here. I started doing the maps in 1995. I did the local photography in 1996. And it's kind of funny. Some of the pictures, I don't know if they're all going to be up here tonight, but some of the pictures in the book of these locations are no longer there.
Right.
And even then, you know, we were worried about how many of these things, you know, would even still be there at that time. And then, you know, today, I think I'll show you at least one picture I know isn't there anymore tonight. So it'll be kind of fun to show this group these pictures because you're going to recognize them, I think, as soon as I put them up on the screen. I'm not telling you much you don't know in some of these cases. So let's go with start with just a short introduction to the battle itself. Okay, so we call it the Battle of Chantilly. That's how the Union soldiers called the battle. Ox Hill, as was called by the Confederate soldiers, was fought on September 1st, 1862. Of course, we just had the sesquicentennial. And the pictures you saw when you first came in, as Mark was talking about, we had a nice sesquicentennial. I can even spell that now. The day, and I ran around with my camera, took a lot of pictures, so I just put them up there, was running through them that you saw earlier tonight. And of course, it was fought 2 days after the Battle of 2nd Manassas, or Bull Run, and 2 weeks before Antietam and South Mountain, hence the timely talk tonight. The main battle lasted 2.5 hours, from 4 o'clock to 6:30. I think it was a Monday afternoon. Approximately 1,500 soldiers were killed, wounded, or captured. Approximately one-third of the Confederate side, two-thirds on the union side. And it's kind of funny because, you know, I have these notes on the soldiers that I got from out at Manassas Park. And you read other books, and there's different amounts of soldiers that were killed or wounded in this particular battle. And that's because, in a lot of cases, the after-action reports were lumped in with 2nd Manassas, so they didn't quite break them out. And so over time, you start to see different numbers. And I don't know exactly which numbers are the most correct, but that was the information I had at the time. What was interesting about the battle was that two generals from the Union side were killed, which was rare. They just fought at 2nd Manassas Bull Run, and no generals were killed. The battle was fought in a late afternoon thunderstorm. And I think we can all relate to late afternoon Washington, D.C. thunderstorms around here. So, you know, they said the thunder was louder than the cannon. And then for those of you with the one cannon that was just out there at Ox Hill, that it has to be pretty loud. The Confederate Army claimed victory, okay, because they held the battlefield at the end of the battle. After 2nd Manassas, you know, long story short, Union Army was in retreat into, you know, eastern Fairfax County, Alexandria, and Washington. And Lee, Robert E. Lee, wanted to get between the Union Army before it could get all the way to the strong defenses in eastern Fairfax County, try to draw them into battle again and destroy them. You know, we read an awful lot about that, that when you have, you know, a victorious army after a major battle, always trying to get after the defeated army and get them into battle again. Unfortunately, the defeated army tends to have a little bit more motivation to move quickly away from the battlefield than the victorious army does. And that, in a sense, was the case here. As we'll talk about, Stonewall Jackson's wing was sent to intercept the Union army. However, they had a long, hard march, you know, to 2nd Manassas, and they were not moving as fast as, you know, we hear the stories about Stonewall's brigade, you know, moving in much faster times. So the Union Army becomes aware, as we'll talk about, of this flanking movement, if you will, by Stonewall Jackson's wing. They come together at West Ox, today's West Ox Road and Route 50, the same roads that were there back in 1862. And they fought this battle in the afternoon. It was ended by rain and thunder, as I said. The next morning at 2 o'clock, the Union Army gets up early. I guess Pepco got the power back on.
Yes, there you go.
The alarm clocks went off. And the Union Army was able to retreat on September 2nd. Hence, on September 2nd, when the Confederate Army is looking to go into battle again, the Union Army is gone. So Confederate Army wins the battle because they held the battlefield, you know, on the tactical front. On a strategic front, the Union Army had defeated Lee's plans to try to cut them off. And we'll show you in the maps where he was trying to cut the Union off. So they did what they wanted to do. As you know, the battlefield now was but 5 acres. It was probably over 400 or 500 acres back then. In 1915, a Confederate donated part of the battlefield was on a Confederate's farm. He donated land so memorial markers could be put up to the two Union generals, because the soldiers were coming back after the war and visiting these battlefields. And in 1883, some of the soldiers, the Union soldiers that fought at Chantilly, had been down at Manassas and then came up and were looking through the fields to find where they had fought at Chantilly. And it was this Confederate veteran who put the court stones out there where Kearney and Stevens were killed, so the Union soldiers could come back and they could find the spots where they had fought and where these generals had died. In 1985, you know, as the battlefield was getting developed, the remains of a Confederate soldier were discovered at a construction site. And his remains were identified, I think, in South Carolina, and he was sent back. So the presentation I have for you tonight is, as I said, our maps of where the soldiers went and pictures. So, as I said, you're going to recognize some of these pictures right away. As I said, I took these pictures back in 1996. So as you look at some of them, you'll see that some of the things have changed. So I started off here. This is obviously the Stone House, the final Union position on August 30th at the end of 2nd Manassas. And this was John Pope's, Major General John Pope's headquarters before he left into the heights of Centerville. Now, some of you I know were here last month when John Hennessy was talking about John Pope. And he was talking about the fact the Pope was brought in, and he was starting to institute a new brand of warfare. You know, perhaps, you know, a harder version of warfare that had been fought before. And there was some dissension in the Union Army about whether this should be done. So as I was sitting there last month listening to John Hennessy talk, I thought about this book that I had in my library called The Hard Hand of War. And it talked about what Pope did and how he kind of changed his focus. And I thought I would read just a couple passages here about some of the orders that, you know, Hennessy was talking about that John Pope issued. And this is back in July 18th, just before, you know, our September battle here. And he had an order that, as far as practical, the Army of Virginia, Pope's army, should live off the land, and only loyal citizens should be paid for goods requisitioned. Another order stated that all the troops should have 2 days' cook rations carried by the troops at all time, and all villages and neighborhoods through which they pass shall be laid under contribution. In other words, they're going to start to live off the land. Kind of interesting language. He says another order, these come in rapid succession, November 7th, local population responsible, he made the local population responsible for curbing sabotage and guerrilla activity on the grounds of the evil disposed person in the rear of persons in the rear of our armies who do not themselves engage directly with the lawless act of courage for giving information. He said, but he says, if a railroad wagon or telegraph line are damaged, all inhabitants within 5 miles of the occurrence would be turned out to repair the damage and pay the indemnity. I don't think he's going to get much money there. If a Union soldier was fired upon, the house from which the shot was fired would be destroyed. If the offense occurred in the open countryside, the inhabitants within 5 miles would pay an indemnity. Okay, any persons detected in acts of sabotage or bushwhacking would be shot without trial. Something, just one more here. Let me see, another one here on July 23rd, order number 11. The unit commanders of the Union Army of Virginia will proceed immediately to arrest all disloyal male citizens within their lines or within their reach of their respective stations. So he's starting to issue these orders. And as for those of you that were here last month, John Hennessy talked about this was a new departure, and he talked about George McClellan. George McClellan did not believe in this type of warfare. And what's interesting in this book, it talks about one of McClellan's orders. It said, McClellan authorized seizure of personal property if necessary for military purposes, but specified that detailed records would be kept and receipts would be issued in all cases regardless of a civilian's loyalty. The idea that private property may be plundered with impunity is perhaps the very worst that the officers of this and soldiers of this army can do. And Mr. Hennessy talked about the fact that, and we'll talk about this a little bit more, that, you know, was McClellan coming, you know, too slowly perhaps to support Pope, okay, because of this, you know, this total disagreement. But we'll talk about that when we get there. So here we have Pope in the Union Army, and I'll start down here, August 30th, the end of 2nd Manassas, in the evening. Pope is going to take his army across, you know, from the Stone House there up today's Route 29, across the Stone Bridge into Centerville. At the same time, this is happening over here. Okay, this is where McClellan's troops from the Union Army of the Potomac are coming up here into the Fairfax Courthouse here, well, in the Fairfax area. The New Jersey 1st Brigade. So we've got this troops coming in both directions, if you will. Union Army of Virginia here under Pope and McClellan's troops coming up from the 7 Days campaign. And of course you recognize this picture of the Stone Bridge, blown up after 1st Manassas, a wooden span built in 1862. Then as the Union Army goes it across again, after 2nd Manassas, they blow up that wooden span again. And of course this is the Union retreat on Route 29, and of course I know you recognize this picture of today. And here's probably the fun part, when you get into Centerville, you know, we have some of these fortifications and so forth, which I know that, you know, we're standing right on in the same area. So this was Quaker Guns at Artillery Hill, okay, Route 29 and Old Centerville Road. This is the old Old Centerville Methodist Church, and of course you recognize that. There's a picture of it today, built in 1854, used as a hospital during the war, burned down during the war and rebuilt in 1870. Now this next picture is my favorite most picture that I took in Centerville. Anybody know where this is? Shelbourne Court. This is a trench that runs through this gentleman's, or family's, backyard. And I just love the fact that this trench goes through here and the fence goes right along there. So this is it's on Shelbourne Street across from Shelbourne Court. And I remember when I took this picture, the rest of the backyard there is fenced in and there's dogs yapping at me. So I just set up my camera and used my long lens so I didn't have to go back there. But I just think that is probably one of the neatest pictures. We've all seen these huts, okay, in Centerville for the Confederates during the winter of 1861-1862. And I know you've heard the story about the one family in Centerville that wrote, you know, at the beginning of the war, we had enough wood on our property to last us for 100 years. By the end of 1861, they said, we don't have anything enough to last us through the winter. So obviously this, you know, lays waste to, you know, civilians in the area when you get 20, 30, 40,000 Confederate troops with 200 villagers in Centerville. And, of course, part of that was right over here at the shopping center, Newgate Shopping Center up on 28 and 29. So as I said, we also have the Union troops coming in. And this is where I, you know, was alluding to the fact, you know, that perhaps McClellan wasn't, you know, hurrying so fast, you know, to come in and help Pope, who we had this disagreement about how to conduct warfare. And I really like the way John Hennessy said it. He said, you know, was McClellan hurrying, you know, to help Pope? He said, McClellan did as he always did. He was moving slow. Okay? So, he, you know, Hennessy, John said last month, he doesn't think that, you know, McClellan would really move slow on purpose, but he, as usual, he did, of course, what he always did. And, of course, here's, you know, the picture of the courthouse during the war. Picture it from the other side today. So some of these sites are quite familiar with you. So let's go on. See, this is August 31st. So the day after the battle, we start again down here in the Manassas battlefield. Robert E. Lee comes up to about the area of the Stone Bridge, and he knows that he can't attack Pope in the heights of Centerville. I mean, even Centerville was higher than it was today before they leveled it out to put the roads in, I guess, you know. So he decides that what he really wants to do, he can't attack the Union Army here in Centerville. And this is when he decides to do this flanking movement up Gum Springs Road. I know you can't read it, but onto the Little River Turnpike today and try to get to this area where today's Route 50 and Route 29 intersect. So if he can get up here and come down here while the Union Army is going, before the Union Army comes through there, this is the idea where he wants to bring the Union Army back into battle again. So, turns out that Jackson's wing, there was two wings at the time, Jackson's wing and Longstreet's wing. Jackson's wing is to the north here. He's going to come across Sudley Springs, up Gum Springs Road, and the plan is to send him down, I guess the Little River Turnpike at the time, but to come down here and push ahead and try to get between Pope and Washington. So he's going to, you know, so his men are coming up here. It's rainy. The roads are muddy. As I said, Longstreet's troops are exhausted, so they're not making their usual speed. However, he's got Jeb Stuart's cavalry, and Jeb Stuart's cavalry is moving way faster, and they come into this 1st New Jersey Brigade, which we saw a little in the last slide. So he starts to do battle there. So, of course, Robert E. Lee, of course, Stonewall Jackson. And, of course, they cross from the battlefield at Sudley Springs. And this is the picture of Sudley Church up there. And then a box spring that was there that was used to collect water. So part of the fun that I had, you know, in doing the book, of course, was going back and taking the pictures again of what they look like. And if you know where if you look where the box springs are, that square box springs here, is the remains of it are here on the side of Sudley. It's not Sudley, I forget what the name of the creek is there. But that box springs is still there underneath the leaves. And I haven't been back there in years, and I don't know if you can still see it today or not, but that is that little area is still there. Stuart is coming down, so that was right there. Again, Jackson moves up, and he comes down. Stuart starts firing on the 1st New Jersey, as we said, in the morning on August 31st. What this does, he doesn't do any damage, okay, but he's moved ahead, and he's actually, well, of course, he's trying to move up to this intersection, and he's got some difficulty there. But what this also does is this starts to send some reports back to Pope down here that, hey, we've got a possible flanking movement going on this way, and Pope starts to send out some patrols. These maps will start to get a little bit busy in here, but what Stuart really does is alert, you know, Pope to something's going on. And as we read about, you know, Pope at 2nd Manassas, he's kind of befuddled by all the things that happened to him there. But, you know, once he gets back into Centerville, he starts to get back on an even keel, and he's starting to figure out what's going on. He's got to protect his army. So he starts to send some troops out here. And we've also got some Union troops coming down here, but he's starting out to send some patrols to feel this out. So this is what's happening, you know, on August 31st. And here's a picture of Mr. Stuart. Stuart fires over here onto the 1st New Jersey Brigade. He was firing from the area of this Pender Vet Clinic along really West Ox Road and Route 50 today. He goes and spends the night up on the area of Navy School right there on West Ox Road.
Thompson Road.
So, again, these are all local landmarks. So let's, but before he retires tonight, he lobs some traffic, some shells down here on Route 29 as well. So this is really tipping his hand over there to Pope. So let's go ahead September 1st. As I said, it gets kind of busy here. Longstreet has left, but has been back at Manassas tending to the wounded on the battlefield. So he starts up, and he's going to follow Jackson into this route coming down here trying to push ahead. He's actually kind of not, he's so far behind, he comes up onto the battlefield after it's over, so he doesn't really play a part in it here. But what you have, the following morning, Pope sending troops out here up to this Rock Hill area. He's sending some troops over here up Walney Road, you know, things that are very local to us. And they're starting to have some skirmishes along here. And what's kind of interesting about the battle, and Ed and I have had this discussion, is although what we write about, you know, occurs right over here, West Ox Road and Route 50, there's still battles and skirmishes going on over here, but a lot of it wasn't really written about because it wasn't all that dramatic. Okay, you know, when you get the two Union generals being killed over here, some of the stuff that goes on over here doesn't sound quite as important. And, you know, and even though we talk about Ox Hill here, remember, a lot of the firing is going on way over here, so hence it was a much larger battle area than, you know, than we see when we go over there and see the 5 acres today. Stuart comes up in the morning from Navy Elementary School. I know it's hard to read. He comes up West Ox Road, comes up to Frying Pan Church, comes back down Centerville Road, and meets Jackson right there at Centerville Road and Route 50 at about 8 o'clock in the morning. And I always, although there is no record of it, I always maintain he went right by my girlfriend, Laura Ratcliffe's house, okay? So I wouldn't be surprised if he had at least stopped and said, hey, who's going by? Because we know Laura was very good at looking out the window and figuring out who was out there on the road. So, of course, there's a picture of Frying Pan Church. And he had reports of the Union soldiers coming through there the day before. Here's another picture of today's Route 50 looking east. This is the intersection where Centerville Road comes across. And I believe the Saunders Toll Gate, as we see on the maps, was over here. Okay. Of course, there are no records Jackson paid any tolls as he took his 15,000 to 20,000 troops past the toll gate. I bet you the toll gatekeeper was hiding or long gone by the time the soldiers came by. But, of course, you know, the toll gates were put in to collect tolls so they would keep these roads in the winter. Okay, it was easy to maintain the roads in the summer, but, you know, when the winter came in, a lot of the roads were not maintained and impossible to use. Okay, so again, we have these troops coming out. Let me get my place here. But what's also happening down here now, I'll point you down here, is that more and more troops are moving this up today's Route 29. Hooker's division, Kearney's division is down here. And in part of the 9th Corps, about 2,000 troops under General Isaac Stevens.
Yeah, Reno was injured.
Reno was injured, not feeling well, actually. And so Stevens takes over. So we have Hooker moving, and Stevens moving. So Stevens' orders are to move up here, find out what's going on. Okay, he's one of the ones that are sent out here, and I believe he was trying to come up here and find West Ox Road. Okay, but as he's coming up here, and he's probably unfamiliar with the territory, he finds a cart path, and he ends up coming up a cart path up to the area of the battlefield as well. Now, before I get to that, as I said, Jackson has met Stuart, and he's moving forward. Again, his troops are not moving so fast, and he moves into the Chantilly Estate area, okay, around 9:30 in the morning until noon, and he stops there. Stuart's way out in front trying to push forward, and nothing's happening there. Again, some battles, you know, some firing going on there. But Jackson's up in the area. I just happened to pick this one picture of the stone house. That was there. It's probably one of the very few, if not the only, structures, you know, from the battle that is still with us today. It's right across from Greenbrier Shopping Center on Route 50. It's right on the grounds of the golf course that's right there. And so that's there. Again, Jackson is not moving so well. But on the other hand, we've got some of this battling going on here, some of this skirmishing going on here, and that slows Jackson down. As we're going to see, he's going to start to send some skirmishers down here. You know, he knows the Union Army is down here, so he's going to send some troops out to protect his flank, the same way the Union Army is trying to protect its flank. So we have Isaac Stevens. He has his orders to go up Little River Turnpike, see what's going on. And Stevens is not one to hold back. And as we'll see, he not only goes up, he goes in. So this was, and again, I took this picture years ago, but this was the cart path off of Route 29. It was Warner's Plumbing at the time. And I've been past there since, and I don't remember what, those buildings are still there, but some other company is in there. And I was never able to walk back up. There's nothing past here to really see what the cart path looked like. Okay, and as I said, you know, it's just all developed now. But it was funny because somebody mentioned to me, well, Chuck, you know, the cart path did run north and south of Route 29. So I just looked across the street, and there it was, you know, on the other side of the street.
Right.
But even this is not there anymore because this has all been developed.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And every time I go by and look, this is kind of overgrown now. I'm not sure if it's cleared out yet, but the last time I was by there, this had overgrown. Unless you knew it was there, you couldn't even tell that anything was there. So this, you know, maybe presents somewhat of a, you know, pictorial of what that cart path might have looked like. Not, you know, going up to Warner Plumbing to get some air conditioning stuff. So Stevens comes up this cart path, okay, and at 4 o'clock he stops and starts to deploy his troops. As I mentioned, Jackson's over here in the Chantilly Estate, and with all that skirmishing going on, he is starting to throw some of his troops out to protect his flank because they're not making any progress going down Route 50. And about 4:30, so the skirmishers from 79th New York comes out, and we've got Jackson skirmishers coming around, and we're starting to have, you know, just small arms fire here, but this is in a sense really the beginning of the battle. As we also have, Stevens sends the 21st Mass and 51st New York to the east side of West Ox Road, okay, and they're eventually going to run into the Confederate troops up here. So for those of you who are at the battlefield, of course, this is where Monument Drive is today. It's almost pretty much right along here.
Yep.
You know, when we were at the sesquicentennial, the markers that we were at are, again, right here as well. No road at the time. Okay. So we have them going into battle. And as Stevens is going in, okay, he as soon as he realizes, okay, we've got close to 15,000 troops here. Stevens starts off with a little, about 2,200 troops.
Right.
He sends back for help. He sends a messenger back down the cart path down to Route 29 for more help that he has found, you know, the Union Army, and he's going in. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't one to hold back. And actually, as Stevens goes into the battle, his son, Hazard Stevens, is in the battle and gets wounded, and Isaac actually comes past him as he's going into battle as well. As they're going up this cart path, they do pass what was called the Millen House down there. And, of course, the Millen House, a lot of the soldiers refer to the Milleners, as I'm told it's really pronounced the Millen House. This became a hospital after the war for the Union soldiers. And so that was a picture of the Mellon House after the war. This served before the battle as Jeb Stuart's headquarters in the early part of the war, end of 1861. And if you really want to know where that is, it was somewhere on this hill where this microwave tower is today. And, you know, and again, it's funny, I drive by there, and it's hard to see that thing because the trees have closed in around it. So this is along West Ox Road. Over here on the right, there's a bus parking lot. So if you're trying to place where this is on Centerville Road, and just to the south, a little bit further south over here, is the trash pickup if you want to go and drop off the landfill and the dump over there. So you go by this. Yeah, Costco's a little bit further down on the left.
Yeah, Chuck, they got pretty good reception there.
Yeah, they got a good reception. Well, they stopped to check. They stopped there to send out a few tweets. You know,
so I have enough bars.
Yeah, Stephen tweeted back to Carney, "Hey, come up. I need to get some help there." You know. So it, you know, it's kind of interesting. You know, so this is, and the reason I just tell you the story is the Mellon House was there, and that what I was told was that the kitchen was either, you know, hanging off the back of the house after the war or after off of here. I spoke to the gentleman who actually got the agreement of the Mellon family who, after the war, had scattered across the country in order to get the permission to sell the property to Fairfax County for the Fireman's Training Center that's there. And so, you know, that's how I came to be told that that was the location of the house. And, of course, once the Fireman's Training Academy was established there, the house burned down. So, you know, that's the way it goes. Funny thing, you know, that's where the house came from.
Haven't lost the foundation yet.
Yeah. So, okay, so we're going into battle. We're starting at 4 o'clock. Stephen, the Union soldiers are starting to punch a hole in here. Stevens decides to lead the charge. He's actually leading the charge in front of the 79th New York Highlanders, a regiment that he used to be in charge of before he was promoted. And they're, of course, called the Highlanders, 79th New York Highlanders. And at the height of the battle here, Stevens runs to the front of his men, picks up the flag, and turns around and supposedly says, "Highlanders, my Highlanders, follow your general."
Right.
Okay, and it's right at that point in time that he turns around and he gets shot and he gets killed. And I say he supposedly said this because his son Hazard writes that, you know, 25, 35 years later in the memoirs of Isaac Stevens. And I actually read an article about that, said, you know, who knows what he really said or if he really said that.
Ouch.
You know, it makes for good reading. It sounds dramatic, you know, sells books. You know, I can understand that. I wish I could come up with some good quotes here. That's the way the history that we have today. Okay, and it's right at 5 o'clock also, if you will, when a thunderstorm breaks on the field, or right around the time that Isaac Stevens is killed. As I said, we have some troops on the east side of West Ox Road. The 21st Mass runs in unknowingly into Trimble's brigade, and they take heavy losses here. This area over here, the 51st New York, is probably about the outreaches of Fair Oaks Mall's parking lot. Trimble and 21st Mass, Isaac Stevens again, as he was killed, he came up the cart path, and here's Monument Drive today. Okay, the monuments are right in there, and that's probably the most likely location where Stevens was killed, right in here. We got the 21st Mass over here. Another interesting thing, you see this little Jubal Early turnaround up here at 5 o'clock.
Right.
He's over here. He hears some of the battles going on, fighting going over here. So he decides to come over here and see what's going on. Problem is only half of his troops follow him. So he kind of comes over, makes a U-turn, and comes back. So that's what that little U-turn is up there. And we've got a number of you can read some of the names up here of who was there. The 21st Mass and Trimble's Brigade were probably fighting in the area here of the Assembly of God Church on Legato Road, which, of course, is still out there today.
Yep.
So that's a little bit of a landmark as to where that 21st Mass was. As I said, the fun part of this is going out and finding where all these things were.
Some of the terrain still exists.
So, as I mentioned, okay, Stevens had sent back, and Carney gets the message and says, "By God, I will support Stevens anywhere." So he and Bernie's brigade actually do come up West Ox Road. They probably got there a little quicker up West Ox Road. Costco is down here, by the way.
Yep.
You know, West Ox Road comes down, hits Route 29.
Yep.
And Kearney comes onto the field, and he comes on. Now, Stevens' men had been fighting over here what was called a grassy field. Bernie's brigade fills in along their left side over here in the cornfield. Fighting is going on. However, Stevens' troops, of course, have been fighting longer than Bernie's troops. And as I said, Stevens was killed about 5 o'clock. The attack falters, and his men start to fall back. Okay? Kearney is over here, and all of a sudden he starts to get reports that, hey, you know, we're taking fire from our right flank now. And Kearney doesn't know about Stevens, of course, you know, the communication's not that instant unless he happened to be right there. And he can't believe that Stevens' men would fall back. And he actually runs into the 21st Massachusetts, who just got shot up over here, and they're coming back across. And he runs into the 21st Mass, and he comes upon them, and it's starting to it is raining now, and he's asking whose troops they are. And they say the 21st Mass. And he says, you should be fighting here. And he said, we've just come from a fight. We're pretty shot up. And Kearney doesn't like that, and the troop is, God damn you, get in there and start fighting. And they don't move, okay? They're not in good shape. They've been moved off. So Kearney, quite a few number of their men. They sustained very heavy casualties. So Kearney himself decides to ride forward in the rain to try to reconnoiter and find out, you know, who's up here. He doesn't really realize who's there. And so there's Kearney there. Unfortunately, he rides into Trimble's Georgia Brigade right up here, or Thomas's. I'm sorry. Get my facts here straight. Got to look at some of my notes. And he asks, you know, whose troops are these? And they reply with 49th Georgia. And he turns around and tries to ride his horse away, now in the mud from the rain. And unfortunately for him, he gets shot and killed as he is riding away. And I believe that it was probably the tip of that cornfield, you know, as we showed on the map, was probably right up here on Monument Drive or so forth. So as I'll talk about later, this John Ballard, who owns the Fruitvale Farm after the war, marries into the Fruitvale Farm after the war, he puts one of those quartz markers here for Stevens, and I believe he probably put one out here in this area for Kearney. Of course, we don't have this one anymore because the road's gone in there.
Yeah.
I did mention in 1985 when the Confederate soldier was found, his body was found when they were building these townhouses over here,
yeah,
a little bit, which would have been, you know, Monument Drive is, you know, pretty much the line between the Confederate troops over here and the Union soldiers over here. So a South Carolinian being found over there makes sense. So, as I said, Kearney is killed around 6:15. And at this point, the soldiers can't load and fire their weapons, their guns, and their muskets, their rifles, whatever, in the rain. Okay, the fighting turns into hand-to-hand combat. Okay, along here in the cornfield, along here in the grassy field. But even that doesn't last very long. And what we have here is, the Union Army has lost its two leaders, and the fighting is getting heavy, and it's hard to see, you know, it really becomes difficult. And both sides kind of have to pull back a little bit here from the actual battle. And so forth. As I said, you know, the Confederate was found right up here at the top of that cornfield. Union soldiers are coming back. And pretty much by 6:30 now, the battle is pretty much over. The fighting is done for the day. What we have the next day, going on to September 2nd, okay, as I said earlier, the Confederates win the battle because they hold the battlefield at the end. But 2 o'clock the next morning, and on September 2nd, from 2:30 in the morning, Union Army pretty much from here and from here on Ox Hill, the battlefield, moved down to Route 29 and complete their retreat. So this is early the next morning. Stevens' body is kept by his men. Kearney's body up here in the front is captured by the Confederate soldiers. They don't know who they have. They know they have a Union officer, so they quickly gather his corpse, and they take it back up into the area of the Chantilly Estate. Okay, again, back up in the area where that stone house is today. We don't know exactly which house his body was taken to. A lot of speculation about it. But a number of the Confederate soldiers, they know Kearny from the Mexican War.
Right.
So they are dismayed. I forget which one says, poor Kearny, he deserved better. But he also is reported to Robert E. Lee, and Robert E. Lee knows Kearny from the Mexican War. Remember, they fought together at one point in time. And General Lee, being the gentleman, writes a nice little note or letter to Kearny's wife, you know, sending back his uniform, some of his equipment, his sword, and some of his things like that. And he does, on the morning of September 2nd, send Kearny's body back with this nice letter written to his wife, you know, saying, sorry, but, you know, here's what I can do. You know, very respectful, you know, when you really think about it, to send it back for somebody that he knew. What's also so Kearny's body and Stephen's body, there's a lot of different accounts, but are probably taken not only down here, but a lot of the wounded soldiers probably came either down the Braddock Road or up Route 29 to West Ox Road and then south to Fairfax Station, where the wounded soldiers from both 2nd Manassas and Chantilly, in a sense, are being triaged, of course, as we know, at St. Mary's Church, loaded on the trains at Fairfax Station and taken into Alexandria, which I believe were Kearny's body and Stephen's body were taken to be embalmed in Alexandria. This is also Janae Ware, who was there at Fairfax Station.
Clara Barton.
Where was Clara? Okay. So of course, this is where, of course, we just had the event out at Fairfax Station that Janae was talking about.
I have to say, the 21st Massachusetts, those were a lot of those men in that were her former pupils.
Right.
And so seven of them came through Fairfax Station, and that's one reason why she became so convinced that she needed to do this work.
Right. They took about the heaviest loss.
Right. So here we have Clara Barton in the beginnings of the Red Cross, and in a sense, the beginning of the Red Cross was to go out to the battlefield to tend to the wounded soldiers as opposed to waiting for them to come back, getting to the soldiers as quickly as they can. So, you know, and as you go down to St. Mary's Church, you see the signs out there about Kearny, and you'll see the signs about Clara Barton down there. After the battle. So this is an interesting picture. So we talked about the Mellon House. That would have been over here to the left. There was also a Reed House on the battlefield, which I didn't point out when we went through there, but that was over more towards to the west of the Ballard House. So Stevens would have come up over here, I believe, on the cart path. Okay, this could have been the cart path, right, I think, coming right through here. West Ox Road over here. I showed the pictures of the cart path. Then it turns and goes back down south to Route 29. So here's a picture of the battlefield, supposedly around, you know, 1900. The fence, Stevens would have been, I think Stevens would have been killed somewhere over here. He would have come, the Union troops would have come up this way. Okay.
So the Little River Turnpike is not in the picture.
No.
It's closer to
no,
us.
No, the little, yes, Route 50 is behind us.
Right.
Route 29 is down south looking this way. Just give you a few minutes. So the Union troops were coming along here. As I said, West Ox Road came up. And that cart path came up over here. So this is looking south, back down towards Route 29. And the Ballard House, so the Ballard House, we'll talk about him in a second, was back over here. I suppose you can see it in the picture over here. I have a hard time seeing it, but it was over here in this area. And as I said, in 1883, a couple Union soldiers come back to the battlefield, and they're trying to orient themselves. And they come across John Ballard on the battlefield with his wife, Mrs. Reed, there, or formerly Mrs. Reed. And Ballard was one of Mosby's men, lost his leg at Ewell's Chapel in Prince William County under Mosby. So they come and they meet, and he takes them out. And actually, I think the Union soldiers take Ballard out in the battlefield after they get their orientation and show him, you know, where they fought, where Stevens was killed, and where Kearny was killed. And Ballard goes out and starts putting rocks on the battlefield to mark these spots, because more and more soldiers are coming back after the war. And once he's got it identified, then He goes out and puts the markers on the battlefield. And one of these was this white quartz stone, and that's right by where the monuments are today. Okay, that's where Stevens was killed. And as I said, I believe the other one was probably out there somewhere in the middle of Monument Drive and is lost to posterity. But what was interesting when we were out there on September 1st, you know, 2 weeks ago, down in that little parking area where all the historical societies were, there were some more white quartz markers. And I spoke to Ed about that. And they uncovered those when they were building that little driveway in there. Apparently, they built it up a little bit, and they had a drainage system, a water drainage system under there. So when the water comes down the hill, okay, it won't flood that little area where they have the little alcove, if you will, of markers. So there's I don't know why I didn't have them in my other presentation, but I know I took pictures of them. So it's kind of interesting. It kind of tells you that these quartz markers were perhaps more common back then. Of course, we don't see a whole lot of anything today. If you get out there, you see this, Kearney Stump. And when they were so in 1915, they're putting these monuments up and having the dedication. And the reference, and this is, of course, you look at this right here, and that's, in a sense, a surveyor mark. So there was a stump of a tree that was used as a reference for this 50 by 100-foot plot that Ballard donates so the monuments could be built. And, of course, at some point in time, obviously, that tree was gone, and they put this there to mark it as well. And, of course, we do see the markers that are there. Mm-hmm. Nobody is buried there.
Right.
Okay.
Kearney is in
Arlington National Cemetery. Buried up, I think it was buried in New Jersey or New York?
That's what I'm saying.
Which?
New Jersey. I think he was buried, it's Kearney, Jersey, sorry. And then he was eventually moved to Arlington National Cemetery. Isaac Stevens is buried up in Newport, Rhode Island, his hometown. So there are, people always ask if anybody is buried there, and the answer is no. People always ask, Kearney lost his left arm in the Mexican War. Is this the stump of his arm?
No.
Buried there? No.
Yeah.
But that's all right. Everybody comes across this, and they're trying to make sense. Luckily, we have some markers out there on the battlefield that, help us out a little bit. There, of course, is the front of the marker for Isaac Stevens. And as I said, where the monuments are is where we believe Isaac Stevens was shot, and he died. As I said, Kearney was, killed by all accounts further to the west, or maybe a little bit north. Mm-hmm. And it kind of makes sense. He would have been riding forward of the Union lines and in the Confederate lines, so a little bit further north, if you will, there. And I'll end with this particular picture. I was telling the guys earlier, this is, in a sense, the battlefield on a rainy day. Remember I talked about the Mellon House being down here? I took this picture on purpose so you could see that microwave tower.
Right.
Okay, the Reed House would have been over here in this area, West Ox Road coming up. Okay, the cart path somewhere along here going to the battlefield. So Stevens would have come up through here approximately, coming into the battle. And I was telling some of the guys earlier that I took this picture from the roof of that one tall building that's right across the intersection. And in order to get that picture, I had to call them ahead of time and say, hey, can I get permission to go up and take a picture off of your roof? And they said, okay. They didn't know what I was, had no idea anything about me. But then
you're
And then I called them back and said, oh, by the way, I want to come up and take a picture in the rain. So I remember how I did this. I worked down in Washington, D.C., and I picked a week that it was forecast to rain every day. Mm-hmm. So I called them up and said, I want to come out in the afternoon. I figured I'd do it on the way home from work. I put my camera in my car every day, and I said, I'm going to come by when it's raining, but not too hard, and say, would you allow me to go up? And they said, yes. So one day I called them and said, okay, I'm coming. And they sent me up there with a security guard to make sure I wasn't doing anything. And that's how I snapped this one particular picture, trying to get a modern-day look of the battlefield in the rain. So that's, again, it's fun taking these pictures. So a lot of preparation goes into it.
Nice clouds.
Yeah, well, that's what I had to do.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, it was drizzling the day I actually took the picture. I didn't want to be in any torrential rain trying it out there. I did have my umbrella, and I set up my camera and my tripod, and the guard's just looking at me, and I look at him, and he looks straight ahead, you know.
The soldiers in the 51st, you know, the 21st and the end,
right.
You knew it, got separated because of that ridge that's still there. Actually,
okay.
You can find that ridge. Those 51st boys thought they were in a cedar swamp.
Yeah.
Because of the rain that was coming out so heavy, they were getting up to, you know, knee deep in the water.
Yeah, you know? It was. You know, we all know what one of those afternoon thunderstorms are here around in this area.
Some lightning in there.
Yeah, I can do that. You know what I'll do? I'll take the lightning out of Sneeden's book with his,
right.
You know, his with his faux picture of the Battle of Chantilly.
Yeah.
All right, that's what I have for tonight. Any questions? Yes, sir.
Yeah, Chuck, just to go back a little bit to Lee and Longstreet. From what you said, there was no attempt by Lee to have Longstreet, even after Jackson had made his flank.
No, I can't do this now.
To go through Centerville and try to trap the Union Army between.
No.
Between the two.
I'm sorry. Let me go back here. Let me go this way. No.
Yeah. Like
Lee. Well, there. You know, all right. You know, we'll get used to this thing yet. Lee knows that he can't go directly against the Heights here in Centerville. I mean, the Union Army would be looking right down on him.
Yeah, but they were retreating.
Right, but still, there was troops in here, and remember, Lee has to move fast. He has to make a decision, you know, relatively quickly. If he's going to go after the Union troops, he's going to start his flanking movement immediately. So again, as we said, Jackson gets out there first. Longstreet has to stay behind, tending to the wounded and the dead, and then he follows. Again, Lee's plan was for both of them to go into battle, but by the time, as I said, by the time Longstreet gets there, they fought this battle at Chantilly, Ox Hill, and the next day the Union Army is gone. Had there been a battle on September 2nd, Longstreet would have been there.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Chuck, the Union Army there. Two of McClellan's corps, the 2nd and the 6th Corps, had occupied Centerville. Polk's army fell back through them on its way to go back to Washington. So there were two full Union corps basically in Centerville.
And as I said, we have, after these first troops get in, you've got more and more Union troops coming up under McClellan.
Right.
So, you know, after the battle, I talked about the Union soldiers. Lee knows he can't stay in this. What you know was written as a now desolate area of Fairfax County. He can't attack the city of Washington, and so this is when he makes the decision to go back up towards Leesburg and then eventually invading Maryland and up to South Mountain and Antietam. Yes, sir.
In December, Fairfax City had Vermont troops in there under Stoughton, and a lot of them went out to the Ox Hill battlefield to visit it. And there was an account written, and I just wanted to talk about hallowed ground again. The bodies were starting to come out of the ground.
Yeah, right after the battle.
And I don't know where those locations were, but I think a lot of...
Yeah, it was written in the newspaper, the Washington Post at the time, that 2 weeks after the battle, the shallow grave, the bones were starting to stick up out of the shallow graves.
It was quite a scandal, wasn't it? The idea of the sanitation corps to try
you initially have a lot of panic. You know, in the city of Washington, Stonewall Jackson and his whole wing is right here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Longstreet is right here. Okay, so initially you get some panic, but then they leave and go north and things settle down again, and then you get the coming back to the battlefield. Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
You said that Chantilly was the name of a farmer.
Estate. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Estate.
Yeah.
Is it where the battle was fought?
No. Let's see if I can do it here. Greenbrier Shopping Center is right around here. I think it's the Centennial Golf Course is right here.
Right.
You go across, right, it's the stone house.
Mm-hmm. It's right on 50.
Is right on 50, right next to the entrance.
Yep, that one right there.
To the golf course. If you go from this stone house, put your car thing on zero, and go a half a mile west, that's where the Chantilly Estate was.
Right.
Okay, this was the overseer's house on the Chantilly Estate. The house is no longer there. It was burned down sometime in 1862 by the Union soldiers who were out there on picket duty because they didn't want to be out there on picket duty anymore. They wanted to go into Fairfax Courthouse, so they burned the estate down, they burned the house down, and went on in. And when you read the records, you know, now we still have Sully today to give us some idea of what, you know, an estate was like during the war. But the Chantilly estate was a bigger estate than Sully, and we know that because it paid more property taxes before the war. Okay? So yeah, I can infer from the fact that they paid more taxes that it must have been a bigger estate. Yes, sir?
When did they change the spelling of Germantown?
To the J, to the G?
Yeah.
Well, the sign says J now.
Yeah, or J or G, yeah. I don't know.
It's
just,
yeah. Been J for a long time.
It's been J, I don't know.
It says G.
Yeah.
That was because
that was it was
yeah, the political correctness.
Now, go ahead. Ed's got the answer. Hold on a second. Ed's got the answer.
The family's name was spelled with a J.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah. But see, nobody ever saw it written out.
When you say Germantown, you assume it's a G, and that's why it's on all the maps of the G. But the family's name was German. Okay. So the
current sign is correct. Yeah.
Basically.
Right. All right.
Yes, sir. Yeah, there's a story after the battle. Stewart tried to do an end around Fairfax Courthouse via Wakefield's Mills Road.
Okay, so the question is, did Stewart try to go around Union Army to Fairfax Courthouse?
Yeah.
The answer is yes. He goes into Fairfax Courthouse, and it's recorded that he visited Antonia Ford, who, as we know, lived in the middle of Fairfax Courthouse. The battle was September 1st. The Confederate Army's there for a couple days, and they cross. Then they go back into Leesburg and across, you know, the Potomac River at White's Ford on September 4th or 5th. And it's written that not only did he, you know, we always say Stewart was a ladies' man. He not only visited Antonia Ford, he visited Laura Ratcliffe as well before he left.
Yeah, the story I heard was that he ran into Union artillery at difficult run.
It's possible. Oh, I'm sure. But, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It didn't stop the Confederates from getting into the courthouse area. Yes, ma'am.
I grew up in this area, and I'm 30 now, and I've never once heard of it. You know, you hear, the battlefield's all over. Now, I know that
the battle has now been dedicated, and there is a bit more knowledge about it. Is there any
outreach that you're aware of more in the schools where they're being taught about this? Or is it still kind of maybe older, but if you happen to look up the window at the sign?
That's why you have Civil War
roundtables. Right. Hey, John, wasn't the county like to give the excuse when they tore up all that land that could have been saved in 1985?
That's true.
Right? They said, it's out in Chantilly. Chantilly.
Sure.
Further west.
I know. Yeah. I can't answer the question to that, but you know, you've got to. This is unfortunately perhaps where you. I mean, they still teach American, you know, Civil War history. Was it fourth or fifth grade? How much they teach about local history anymore? I don't know. I graduated from those classes. I think I did.
In defense of high school history teachers, if you saw what state requirements were for them, you know, you're lucky to get World War II in there.
Yeah. Well, that's my age group. We never got past the Depression.
Janae.
Just to follow up on that, last fall we were trying to have Julia work out for women to talk to all the schools. We were willing to do it for free, and they did not have time.
One thing we tried to do, and just to follow up on that, one thing we really tried to do, and this roundtable has done, is to try to put historic markers up and Civil War trail signs everywhere that we possibly can. At least put the story out there.
Right.
If you drive along and see
local sites,
right.
Yeah. It's taken a while, but we do have some markers out there at Ox Hill. You can walk along a trail that they put in there, and you can follow.
Just as in school.
It's much better than it was. I don't know. I think are they still working on a couple more signs, Ed?
There's six more signs to go in outside the park.
Okay, right. Round.
Along Monument Drive.
Yep.
All the way across the battlefield.
Right.
And there is one more panel to go down in the kiosk.
In the kiosk area.
Good. For the soldiers.
Right. So they are making an attempt not only to give some interpretation of the battlefield itself, but to put some things around it. So a little, it's always coming. course, it's taken a long time to get here today. But
you can't miss the site if you go to the movies there at Fairfax Town Center.
Yeah, well, somebody put the Fairfax Town Center is now there. I actually took the pictures out. I have to admit, you know, when I used to give this presentation, I had almost twice as many slides in there. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking to myself, I must have really talked fast to get through that in 45 minutes. So before I came tonight, I kind of took some of them out. I was just whipping through this stuff so fast before. I thought I'd slow it down a little bit, try to get your bearings and looking at all the maps and so forth. Mm-hmm. But, you know, where that Fairfax Town Center is in the movie theater was really where the Confederates, the mass of the Confederate soldiers were.
Right. Yeah.
And they do have a little marker in there, I think, somebody put up over there. Yes, sir?
That Miller House, you mentioned that.
Mellon.
Mellon House.
Yeah.
Was Stewart's headquarters.
Yes, Camp Quivive, or however you want to say it.
I read that he calls it Quivive or something like that.
Camp Quivive. I call it Quivive. I'm not French.
So that's where it was.
That's exactly where it was. Mm-hmm. And that's however you want to pronounce it. Mm-hmm. That's French for who goes there. So, of course, here's in the fall of 1861, Stuart's out there, 1,500 or so horsemen, and he is the front vanguard, if you will, of the Confederate army should the Union soldiers come out again after First Manassas. Should they come out again before the Confederate Army leaves? And it was, you know, it was kind of a challenge as to who goes there. It was a way of questioning one's loyalties. You know, who are you? Who goes there? Are you Northerner? You know, mm-hmm. Southerner and all that. But yes, that was his headquarters.
That's where Laura and Antonia Ford met him. They were kind of promoted there. And their stories are just amazing.
Yes. So after Drainsville in December 61, this is where Stuart runs into Laura Ratcliffe. Stuart's wounded soldiers from Drainsville, which of course is north of the Chantilly, some of the wounded soldiers come to Frying Pan Church. Some of his wounded soldiers come over to the Mellon House. Okay, it's recorded that that's where Stuart met Laura Ratcliffe at his headquarters. She only lived a mile and a half from the Frying Pan Church. So although I don't have proof, I think it's possible he could have met her there, and then perhaps the wounded soldiers were taken over to his headquarters. And Antonia Ford and Laura were cousins. So there's records of during the war, Laura and Stuart writing letters to each other, and Stuart writing a letter, at least one letter, to both Miss Ratcliffe and Antonia Ford in Frying Pan. And there's records of his officers giving rides to two ladies, which I assume were Antonia and Laura. And like you said, there's a very fine book in the back of the room on Laura Ratcliffe.
Yes, there is.
Any other questions? I thank you all.